on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting again with 93-year-old Victor Killingsworth of Taft, California. If you missed the first half of his story last week, you can find that podcast online at hometownheroesradio.com. When we left off, he had shared some of the close calls he experienced on Saipan, concluding with the way that he and some other Americans ended up saving some civilian inhabitants of Saipan from those suicide cliffs of Marpi Point, an infamous spot where thousands took their lives because of Japanese propaganda promising mistreatment by Allied conquerors. You heard Mr. Killingsworth also confirm that he believes those civilians may have saved his life and the lives of other American soldiers and sailors there with him because they were unknowingly behind enemy lines, and the presence of those civilians may have prevented hidden Japanese forces from firing upon them.
You know, I know I'm bouncing around here, but you talked about the thing that led up to that, where there was that deception and the ambush, and of course, the Pacific was famous for the booby traps that the Japanese had everywhere. And you actually had an instance where you were near the commanding general of your forces who almost got taken out by a booby trap. Where was that?
Well, when after they had mopped up Saipan, they had to take Tinian. It was 3 miles away. And again, I volunteered to take troops over there. So I had 75 landing boats. We loaded them on the beach at Saipan, and we went across 3 miles of open ocean water to land on two tiny little beaches on Tinian, which the Japanese did not think anyone would ever try to land on. Because normally it takes, 400 yards of beach to unload, to land a division. We had one beach that was 50 yards, the other one's 100 yards. So they were very tiny. We left Saipan, and I had these boats all strung out behind me, and we had made a feint at Tinian Harbor, and we had sent the amphibious ships there, and they fiddled around. We put some boats in the water. The Japanese pulled everything out to Tinian Harbor, thinking that was the ideal place to land, because it had a big white beach, beautiful place to land, and they thought we would do that. So they had left the area where we were going exposed. But when by the time they found out about it, they sent their tanks back to defend it. So they were coming on a road above the beach, and they started firing at us with the tanks. Well, all of a sudden, my landing boat was heading out to sea. I got down behind the steel plate, too. And I thought, where in the world are we going? I looked up, and my coxswain was sitting on the floor of my landing boat with his hands up like this, and he was steering the thing. And I thought, wow, I better. So I got my head up, and all 75 of my boats are going out to sea. And I told the coxswain, stand up where you can see what you're doing. And I had in my boat, I had the commander of the Marine Forces in a Jeep with a trailer. And the Jeep trailer was full of mortar ammunition. So as we were going, one of the shells from the Japanese tanks hit right beside my landing boat, and the water went up in the air because the water keeps it from going sideways. So I went up, and the water came down all on top of my boat. And the boat group commander come crawling out from under the Jeep, and I was sitting there laughing. And I was thinking, that shell hit this boat, we'd just be a grease spot, you know, because we had all that mortar ammunition. So I was laughing, not at him, but thinking about the situation. But he thought I was laughing at him. So he told me, he said, the next time a shell comes that close, I'm going to dig a foxhole right in the middle of your boat. I never will forget that.
That would be a first. Yeah. And didn't you tell me a moment ago you didn't have any close calls? Yeah, likely story. And then General Holland Smith, who you use his affectionate nickname liberally in your book, tell us what that is.
Well, once we got settled there and we built our base at Tinian Town, General Howland Mad Smith and his group came ashore.
That's Howland Mad. Holland was his real name. You guys called him Howland Mad?
Yeah, because he was out loud. He knew what he wanted all in it. But anyway, he came ashore with two guards with Thompson submachine guns at their hip, and then his aides and so on. It was a group of about 6 or 8 walking down the Jap Pier right next to our camp. And one of his aides went down and, hey, look what I got. And he picked up a booby trap, and it went off. And fortunately, he just got shrapnel in his ear. So it was an easy way to win a Purple Heart, but he was fortunate he and the general didn't get killed.
And we did have generals killed under similar circumstances in the Pacific. I know we're running short on time. I don't want to leave out Iwo Jima, because everybody has seen the iconic image that Joe Rosenthal snapped atop Mount Suribachi. But you saw it from a little different perspective. You weren't quite as close up, but you saw that same Stars and Stripes. How did that all unfold?
Well, after I left Tinian and went back to Pearl, I was reassigned to USS Artemis, aka 21, an attack cargo ship, as a assistant communications officer. So when we went to Iwo Jima, we had reserve units. We had reserved heavy equipment, and we had about 300 reserve Marines. Well, again, that battle was so tough. That was the toughest battle the Marine Corps says they've ever been in. They took the 300 men off the first day. And some of the equipment they began to take off as they could, and the captain of our ship moved up as close as he could get to get this equipment off. So we were fairly close to Mount Suribachi, and I was on the bridge came over the radio that the Marines had just taken Mount Suribachi and placed the American flag on there. So I ran the wing of the bridge with my binoculars, and I was able to see the second flag being hoisted out Iwo Jima.
Yeah, and folks who have read up on it or have listened to this program faithfully over the years are aware what you mean when you say the second flag. I'm guessing, though, that there are quite a few out there listening today who say, wait a second flag? I only know the one flag I've seen in that photograph, which, of course, has been everywhere over the last 70 years and, of course, is captured in 3D form in the beautiful statue at the Marine Corps Memorial outside Arlington National Cemetery. So let's go through a brief synopsis before I get back to your feelings about seeing that flag up there. The first flag atop Mount Suribachi went up a little before 10:30 in the morning on February 23rd, 1945. A 40-man combat patrol had been sent to take the high ground, handed a flag from the transport ship USS Missoula, and told to put that flag up if indeed they took Suribachi. So once they reached that summit, they put the flag on a pipe and hoisted it up. They even had a photographer there to take a picture. It really wasn't that big of a flag, just a small red, white, and blue speck from the shore below. But James Forrestal, the Secretary of the Navy, was so moved by seeing it up there that he decided he wanted it as a souvenir. Of course, the Marines who took the hill weren't very happy about that, so Marine Colonel Chandler Johnson sent a crew of his guys to get that flag and replace it with a bigger one. It was that second bigger flag that Joe Rosenthal turned into perhaps the most famous photograph of all time. There were two other Marine Corps photographers up there with him. The one who took the color film, moving pictures of that flag raising, maybe you've seen that, Bill Janost was his name. He would later be killed in action. And of the six men pictured in the famous photo, three of them would die on Iwo Jima. The story has so many twists and turns. There are some great books about it, and of course that movie that Clint Eastwood produced in recent years, Flags of Our Fathers, covers a lot of ground. Anyway, that's why you said the second flag. But when you saw it, what did that mean to you to see Old Glory up on that high ground in a battle that claimed the lives of over 6,800 Americans?
Well, it was a very inspiring and sobering, a very sobering thing to think about. We didn't know how bad the battle was at that particular time, but I knew I was thankful that I hadn't been in landing boats, because when they tried to land at Iwo Jima, it was in black volcanic sand, and it was about 10 foot high from the water line to the top of the bank. And as the Marines tried to walk up that, it was like walking in sand. They could slip back. It was very difficult to get up off the beach. And then they tried to put tanks in there, and they got bogged down. And it was absolute disaster. Landing boats were upside down, turned over. Tanks were in the water. It was an absolute mess trying to get on the beach there at Iwo.
And you had done that job at previous landings, so you knew what it was all about. And you said you didn't know how bad the battle was. It actually got worse after they put the flag atop Mount Suribachi. A lot of people forget. Anything else about Iwo Jima, anything that you saw or experienced there that stands out for you?
Well, the captain, as I said, tried to get in as close as he could to unload the equipment. and he got a little too close because the Japanese set up a mortar on the beach on a cliff right near us and fired a mortar round. I was on the bridge when it hit in front of the ship, and the captain was on the bridge also, scared him to death. He ordered full steam up reverse, and he put the ship. Fortunately, we had steam up. We were underway, so it was easy for him to, and we started backing up. And as we backed up, the Japanese kept firing, and they kept hitting in front of us. So fortunately, they never did hit our ship. But I thought that was unique that mortar rounds could be fired from the beach at a ship. And we were too close.
Definitely too close in that instance. I tell you, I'm not trying to put thoughts in your head. I'm interested in your take on it. But I hear all these stories, and it sure seems like somebody was looking out for you. What do you think when you look back at all those situations? Do you feel like you were experiencing some kind of protection there?
Well, I knew my wife was praying for me. She
wasn't your wife yet.
Oh, my girlfriend. She was a strong Christian, and she told me she was. And I'm sure my mother and others had a lot to do with my safe return.
Did you ever think that you weren't going to come back?
No, never did think that. But that's training again. You know, when you're trained up to do a job, you have confidence. That's the only way you can win. You got to have confidence. You got to have the feeling you're going to succeed. And we were trained to that.
What do you think is the most frightened or unnerved or just scared that you ever were?
Well, I really hadn't thought about it like that. I was always concerned, you know, that this is kind of a tight spot we're in here. But I don't remember being afraid or scared. Like you say, it's all in the training. It's in the training.
Well, obviously well trained. Where were you when the war ended?
When the war ended, we were coming back. After Iwo Jima, we went back to the States, took on port director units, and they sent us back to Japan. We were one of the first ships in Tokyo Bay. We were exploding mines as we went in. So that's how early we were going in there.
So it was on the way there that you heard.
And then, so we put port director units in Yokohama and some of the northern Hokkaido, some of the northern islands. And then we were sent home. And about 2-3 days out of San Francisco, I was a communication officer on the ship. And about 2 days out of San Francisco, I was decoding a top secret message, and it said, "Lieutenant Killingsworth, you are hereby ordered to report to Naval Base, 12th Naval Base in San Francisco." So when the ship came in, I was loaded and ready to take off and couldn't wait to get to a telephone to call my girlfriend and say, "Let's get married."
But you waited a long time. I mean, I think you saw her, what, January 1st, was it?
Yeah. No, I got into San Francisco on the 10th of December. And she came out from Virginia with her mother, and we were married January 5th.
You hadn't seen her for 2.5 years, but you'd been writing these letters, and you hadn't asked her to marry you until you were back.
I think we had an understanding, pretty much, yeah. She and I, but that was a big deal when I got back, yeah.
Because I think in your book you say on New Year's Eve you had your first date in 2.5 years, and then on January 5th you got married.
That's right. It was fast, you know. War does strange things, doesn't it?
And they say if it's fast, it's not going to last. But 68 years later, I guess you've proved otherwise.
Yeah, it's been a short 68 years.
What do you think's the secret to the success of your marriage?
Keep your mouth shut.
Pretty simple advice, but oh, so hard to follow sometimes, isn't it? Victor Killingsworth of Taft, California, our guest today, and we're not done yet. When we come back, we'll hear about some of the unique souvenirs he brought home from his Navy service in World War II, what he saw that convinced him the atomic bomb saved his life, and we'll also hear about the genesis of his book, The Gator Navy. If you'd like to get your hands on that book, which is part of the library at the Naval Academy in Annapolis, you can call Mr. Killingsworth at his home in Taft. Here's his number, 661-765-2360. Again, that's area code 661-765-2360. I have that number posted along with his email address on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page and at hometownheroesradio.com. Back with the rest of Hometown Heroes right after this. If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there, free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkerncounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, cvhonorflight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor. From now through the end of April, Sleep Retreat is closing out three of the most popular models of Tempur-Pedic mattresses. This is a limited-time offer and a chance to save up to $2,000 on the best-selling Tempur-Pedic Rhapsody, Cloud Supreme, and Contour Select models. When these models are gone, this sale is over, so don't wait. Call the store and reserve your Tempur-Pedic closeout model and save up to $2,000 today. Sleep Retreat is part of the Fashion family of furniture stores, so you know you'll get the best possible customer service. Sleep Retreat on El Paso. So just steps from the main store.